Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Investing Simplified. And this morning in studio with me is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck, and a beautiful morning it is.
Yes, it is, absolutely. And we're going to have a special guest on the air. We've been promoting it on the on our website, also in the on the web, and also for you people who listen to us on iTunes, or go to www.freedom970.com. Hopefully you're on the air and you have our numbers. If you have a question, you can call us at 503-417-7626 or toll free 800-990-0750. We've been promoting this week because we have with us on the air, live from Florida, Harry Dent. Harry, are you there? Well, we'll be getting Harry on the line with us. We're going to have Harry Dent, the economist, author. He's also the senior editor of Economy and Markets. And if you haven't signed up for that newsletter, I've been talking about this for several years now. You can go on our website, or you can go to hsdent.com. You can sign up for Economy and Markets Daily. It's an email you'll get every day. It's full of information from Harry and his staff. And I got to tell you, it's worth a lot. And we've got Harry on the line now. Harry, are you there? Hi, Harry, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, good. I was just promoting your newsletter, and I was just going to talk about also about your Irrational Economic Summit. Now, is that sold out, or is it still available?
No, actually, I just saw they put out a thing. There's 300 and, well, no, I'm not. Actually, I think that there's still spots. I saw some. There's still spots available.
Well, this is a great opportunity for all of our Northwest listeners. Harry's going to be at the Fairmont Hotel September 10 to 12, and I've already booked mine. I booked mine when it first came out, because this is an opportunity for you, the listener, to go to a action-packed couple days of unbelievable information, economic information, that if you're an investor of any kind and you don't go to this, you're missing a golden opportunity. But
Harry, we have a broad range of speakers, as you know. It's not just me and Rodney and Adam. We're going to have like 13, 14 speakers from all types of angles and different alternative investments. So, yeah, it is a very comprehensive conference.
Well, you're going to have two of my favorite people, Lacey Hunt and David Stockman, as well.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
You and Rodney are worth the price of admission alone. But when you start adding some of these other speakers you've got an action-packed, and I got to tell our listeners, this is an opportunity, and you can also buy a CD of it at that, or if you attend, too. So it is a great action-packed couple of days that you just can't miss. Well, listen, Harry, there's a lot to talk to you about the economy, and one of the things that we've been talking about with you for the past year, and maybe even longer than that, but is about the true unemployment in this country. And finally, the numbers came out, and we have the worst percentage of people working in America in 37 years.
Yeah, like I say, they keep saying, the unemployment rate keeps edging down, but workforce participation has been edging down rapidly over the last several years. A lot of people are either giving up on the workforce or job prospects, or they're just saying, you know, I'm a baby boomer in my 50s or early 60s. I might as well just retire early. You know, why? It's too hard. So yeah, when you look at the total workforce from the peak to now, you know, there's been nowhere near the progress that the unemployment suggests. And also, even of the people employed, if you adjust for people who are part-time but don't want to be, because the part-time jobs have gone up much faster than the full-time, then we're really still at 10 to 11% unemployment by that measure, and that peaked at more like 11% at the worst of the crisis. So we've made almost no progress on that measure.
Well, and I got to tell you, we talked to you last month about this, and I was at a meeting the other day with some individual people about investing and stuff, and I was trying to explain to them, they were all saying, you got to dump all your money into gold. And I was telling them, hey, you better get Harry's free newsletter. You better start getting some information about what's going to really happen to gold, because it's not what you think it's going to be.
Yeah, and we've been – the two things I get argued about them – I mean, you know, when I lecture, I'm on the – after being bullish for decades, I'm on the bearish side. Look, the baby boomers are done spending, and the geopolitical cycle couldn't be worse, and we've got a great cycle on that continues to point down for 5 years, and stocks are overvalued. And I go on and on and on. The two arguments I get are from the gold bug crowd, where they're like, yeah, but well, if you're right, then gold's going to go to 5,000 and the dollar's going to collapse. And I'm like, no, we've been saying for years the opposite, because this is not the 1970s inflation recession crisis. This is a deflationary, what we call a winter season downturn, where debt bubbles deleverage and money is destroyed. Financial bubbles are at extremes, like similar in the Roaring Twenties. And when those bubbles burst, massive amounts of wealth are destroyed, and it doesn't come running back like in past years. And you get deflation. You get less dollars chasing the same goods. And gold is saying, yeah, there's a crisis coming. But then every time the crisis hits, like in late 2008, it's deflationary in nature. And gold says, gold goes crying to mommy is what it does. It went down 33%. And the U.S. dollar went up 27% in the second half of 2008. And that's when the real crisis hit. So we're saying that's going to happen in the next couple of years, especially, and the dollar's going to go up even more, and gold's going to go down even more. I would not be – we're looking at gold hitting something like $700, $740, its support back in late 2008, you know, in the next couple of years. And gold bugs are thinking, oh, it's finally bottomed, and next move's going to be up to 5,000. I mean, we were fighting that even when it looked possible when gold was near 2,000. It is not even a possibility today. We've had unprecedented stimulus, money creation, and we haven't got inflation. It's because we're in a deflationary phase, and the central banks are fighting deflation with inflation. It's not possible to create hyperinflation or high inflation rates in this economy. I mean, central banks, when have they ever printed more money than this? And they got no inflation.
Say, Harry, you know, Chuck and I attended a meeting the other day, and one of the members of our little business group is in the energy industry, and he had attended some big conference of energy leaders throughout the United States. And he said that the general takeaway that he took from this meeting was that they're predicting a huge increase in electricity costs for a variety of reasons here and everywhere. And I just kind of wondered if that was something on your radar screen.
Yeah, you know, we really don't see that. We've been saying oil prices would go down to $10 to $20 a barrel, and we've already seen $42 recently, much faster even than we would have predicted. We're in a deflationary period. In a deflationary period, you overexpand in a bubble boom like we saw in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And debt is a lot of, you know, debt grows at 2.5 times the economy in the recent case. And that just expands production. We overproduce, we overconsume. And then when reality hits, you got too much stuff. And when you got too much stuff, you got excess capacity and the prices go down. I mean, people may not be able to control their wastewater much, but they certainly can cut back on electricity in hard times. They can cut back on toll roads, all types of things that people think, oh, these are stable things. Well, not in a time like this. So, and iron ore, coal prices have absolutely, and oil, all these energy inputs into utilities and stuff has absolutely collapsed. How could electricity prices go up in this environment? I think these people are just like the bubble stock analysts, where they just don't see reality because they can't afford to. They can't see their industries having this sort of deflation and having to make this sort of change. And so they just go into denial.
Well, you know, Harry, I've been following you since the 80s, and we've been through some some great times and some hard times. And one of the things been the last few years has been really difficult because people just don't grasp demographics. And it's so logical if you understand how it works. It's so logical. It makes the economy logical to you. But you've the last few years you've called your summits irrational because the economy is so irrational right now. The guys on TV, the guys that are talking stocks on TV, have not got a clue of what's going on in the economy.
Yeah, you know, the recent thing, for the first time, and we've been predicting this, earnings are actually going to be negative and slow after a long run-up, and earnings go through extreme cycles, and they don't just flatten out. They go up extreme, and they go down. And now they're in denial about this. The stock market's going up despite earnings going down. China just saw their exports, which is their big thing that they do, is a manufacturer for the world, drop 15% year over year, and the stock and the Shanghai composite goes up 2%. Like, is that delusion or what? And they're the same logic that the bubble stock analysts have here. Oh, well, if the economy gets weak, then central banks will print even more money, and that money will go in the stock market. You know, so it's the same perverted logic. You can't keep a bubble going forever. And I think this one is very, very close. It may even be peaking here in late March. We've been looking for a turn point, number of markets like the DAX in Europe and oil and gold and the U.S. dollar and euro and U.S. stocks, and they all seem to be turning here. We're going to have to wait a few more weeks and see if there's more downside or reversal follow through. But I think it's possible we just saw a peak in the stock markets. And if not, you know, we're certainly due for at least a 20% correction, which if I was an investor, I wouldn't want to sit through since it could turn into more than that. And our most bullish scenario is that we get a 20% correction this year, central banks step in one more time and do the great money printing thing, and you get a slight new high before things just totally fall apart, because things are starting to fall apart. Germany has been disappointing the last year. Demographics tells us that's going to get a lot worse, just like Japan in the 90s. The real estate market in China has been starting to go down for the first time. And that's why people are jumping into stocks. You know, just like we jumped from tech stocks to real estate speculation in 2004 when the tech bubble started to burst, their real estate bubble's bursting. So investors there are saying, well, now we'll speculate in stocks. Well, that shows the real estate bubble's bursting. If that bubble bursts, the world will never hear a louder thump than that bubble falling. And you got Singapore, who is leading real estate now down in East Asia, because they were forced by their own citizens to put strong curbs on foreign buying and speculation, because the citizens say, look, this is a rich country. We make $50,000 to $200,000 a year. The average person makes $60,000 per capita, more than the U.S., and these people are saying, we can't afford to buy a condo in Singapore. So get these foreign speculators out of here. So that real estate market is going to fall sharply. It already has started to. So, you know, something's going to prick this bubble in the next year, and I think sooner than later. So I just tell investors, if you look at the history of bubbles, yeah, they build fast, usually over 5 to 6 years in stocks, but they burst much faster in two and a half years. And in the last tech bubble that peaked in March of 2000, within 2 months, the first crash was 40%. It was 80% ultimately, but half of that whole crash happened in the first 2 months. So if you waited to see proof that the bubble was burst and, oh, it's finally over, I say you're better to get out and give up the last 5 or 10%, if there's even that, and not sit there and wait for proof, because you may be brutally surprised.
Well, you know, I noticed a lot of the news people yesterday. I was watching it, and they were just cheering because the market crashed in the morning, and they were just cheering that it would get back because it had lost all its gains of the year almost in one day, yeah, or in a week, and they were cheering that the market got back and didn't have a negative for the year. I mean, what kind of optimism is that in reality? They're cheering that the market got back, so we're even for the year.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to watch this, and it's pervasive, and that's the way bubbles are. You know, we're the smartest species on the earth, but when it comes to bubbles, we're dumber than toads. I'm just telling you, it's all throughout history. The reason is bubbles are like a high. You're getting something for nothing. You know, okay, normally, okay, you're working, maybe you're getting a little salary raise and stuff, but when your house starts going up 10 or 15% a year, or your stock portfolio starts going up 20% plus a year, you're getting wealthy rapidly and not doing anything. You're just sitting there. So who wants that to end? And it is a high. You know, you feel better when that happens. So everybody ends up getting in this, hey, it's not a bubble, or if they do recognize it's kind of a bubble, well, why not keep this going? You know, why not let the government just print money? The government's literally printing money at a rate commensurate to offset the downturn, the slowdown of the economy, to keep enough money flowing into the financial markets so they don't go down. So stocks are going to go up. It's the last place people can go because they made bonds yield zero or negative now, adjusted for inflation. It's the last place investors can go. And they'll just keep piling in until something goes wrong. But something will go wrong, just like the subprime crisis, which nobody, did Ben Bernanke see that? Did the top politicians see that? Did the top economists see that? None of them saw it. It was only four states, but that's all it took to have a subprime mortgage bubble start to burst in four states, and then everybody started worrying about debt and debt defaults and blah, 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 blah. Next thing you know, you got a worldwide crash and recession. So it's not going to take a lot. With the economy stretched so far, another 7 or 8 years of bubble, you know, economics and governments just printing money as fast as they need to and as much as anybody could possibly dream. We've stretched this thing so far. It's not going to take much to burst it. I think the China bubble bursting in real estate is going to be the final nail, if not the first. And I think that Germany is just going to get weaker over the next few years. And if Germany starts to slow down like the southern European countries have, in which their demographics say they will, how is it going to even be remotely possible for the Eurozone to hold together? Germany is the anchor for that whole thing.
You know, Harry, we were listening to a fellow who has a very long track record of very successful stock picking and really smart guy. And as I listened to him the other week, I said, gosh, you know, he's saying all the things that Harry says, but he just says it it's kind of like in a different voice. And what it really brought home to me was what he was really saying was, you got to realize the bad things so that you can, you know, and if you're good at it, you can pick good stocks. And his whole philosophy was, pick the stocks that have the earnings. And you're like you're saying, there the earnings are all falling apart. So I said last week, I said, gosh, this guy is just saying what Harry does. He just says it in a different way. So,
well, you know, there's one thing that people don't get, because I have people come to me all the time and say, well, hey, I'm in Procter & Gamble, and it pays a good dividend, and blah, you know, I'm in, you know, they sell toilet paper, they sell detergent, they sell soap. I mean, these things aren't going to slow down. I said, that's not the point. The biggest thing, yes, earnings go down for most companies, some a little, some a lot. The biggest thing that happens is that the price-to-earnings ratio, what investors are willing to pay when things look rosy like today versus what they're willing to pay for an earnings stream when the world looks dangerous or it looks like downward trends, can be the difference between 20 to 30 price-earnings ratios and 5 to 10. That's the biggest part of the stock crash. I went back to the 30s. And looked at everything, cigarettes, booze, soap, utilities, telephones, things that are very recession resilient, and some of them that even do better. All of these stocks, even utilities, went down in the 30s because the price-earnings ratios collapsed for everybody. So even if you find companies with earnings, unless it's like some extreme biotech that's about to cure cancer, you're probably still going to face substantial downside risk. So we just say, I mean, I'm just doing a report today for our next newsletter, and it's just like, you look at the generational spending wave, when this 46-year lag for peak spending for a generation is pointing up, and when it's down, you average 11% in the upturns and like minus 1% in the downturns. Well, why would you want to be sitting in stocks for 13 to 15 years when the fundamental demographic trends are working against you, and you could make at least 2 to 3% in some you know, high quality bonds?
Amen.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been pushing your free newsletter for well over a year now, and we've been telling our listeners to sign up, and I've been sending out on on Twitter and social media and telling them that they need to be getting your newsletter. And you had a real interesting segment there about that you talked about what's really driving wealth inequality. Because that's on the news right now. That's all you hear from these people is we have to equalize earnings. We have to make everything fair for everybody.
Yeah, you know, the best way to do that, have a great reset and a great deflation. I mean, that's what happened in the 30s. The 30s was hard on everybody, but guess who lost the most relatively? It was the top 1%, the top 10%, the top 0.1%, because they own all the financial assets. When a bubble like this gets so extreme and burst, yeah, some everyday people lose their job and they lose some of their financial assets, but they don't have that much financial assets. And homes don't go down as much as stocks. It's the rich that own, you know, growth businesses and stocks and financial assets, and they're the ones. The difference between how rich the rich were versus the poor between 1929 and 1976 got cut more than in half. It went from like 52% of net worth down to 26%. So the rich are still richer, but they get hit the hardest. The only way to equalize is to let the economy reset. As long as the government is still pumping up the bubble, still pumping money in the economy, where does that money go? It doesn't go to the everyday household. It doesn't go to reduce their mortgage. I mean, with all the money they printed, I think I calculated they could have sent every household in the country $30,000 to $40,000. Might even been $60,000. I'll have to, but you know, they printed $3.5 trillion. Divide that by whatever, 110 million households, and you could have sent everybody $30,000+. Don't you think the average person would have rather gotten that, or their mortgage written down by $30,000 to $40,000? No, it all went into speculation that favors investment managers. You know, major growth businesses and Fortune 500 companies can buy back their own stocks at almost zero interest, increase their earnings per share without growing. They can do all these mergers and acquisitions that usually aren't fruitful. Most analysis shows that, but they can do it for almost free and engineer. They do LBO, leverage buyouts. They're doing nothing but financial engineering, and that's the reason earnings are going up, and that's the reason stocks are going up, not because the economy is growing, not because the everyday person is spending or is as productive as they were in the past. This is a phony economy, but it is only sustaining this income inequality and making it worse. So the governments can talk about, oh, we're for the people. Well, in this case, since you want to defend the banks, and that's what they're really doing, keeping the banks and financial institutions going, you are only favoring this top 0.1% even more than ever. So cry me a river on that. You know, you're not representing the people here.
You know, Harry, one of the things I used to work for General Electric years ago as a manufacturer's representative, but you kind of get to know the culture there. And during that time, GE grew this huge financial services business, you know, and now they're talking. I just heard on the radio the other day that the GE is getting ready to, you know, spin off their financial stuff. And historically, what old Jack Welch used to say, if you're not going to be number one or number two, you're fired. you know, and I'm wondering if GE knows something that, like, you know, you're predicting the financial meltdown again of some sort.
Well, you know, now, what they're saying is that the regulations have become so severe on the industry since they screwed up so bad that it's harder to make money. And that's true to a degree, or maybe more in the business they're in. But all I can tell you is they got really good timing, whether they're doing it for the right reasons or the wrong reasons. This is the equivalent of me telling somebody, just get out of stocks here for a while and see if I'm right about the next crash, and don't worry about getting another 3, 4, 5, 6% if you're lucky. Just get out, because the risk greatly outweighs the reward. This is going to prove to be a very, very good decision for them.
I that's what I figure. They've always been pretty darn smart when I was with them, and I was always impressed with it. So it just struck me as interesting.
Yep.
Well, you know, Harry, one of the things about, to me, the irrationality of everything is I listen to these guys on TV, and I know, unfortunately, right now, our society is all around news right now, information right now, and stuff right now. And these people that are on TV all have something they're selling. If they don't get listeners and they don't get advertisers, they don't have a program. So they're all promoting whether it's rational or not. But when I listen to them, if anybody out there is even listening to these people, particularly when I've heard a couple of them interview you and you've talked to them about deflation, and they're still saying we're going to have hyperinflation.
I know. I'm like, okay, I could see that it might take a year or two for all this money printing to work in the economy. It's been 6 years now. So we've had all the opportunity for all this printed money to work, and it's not causing inflation because it's not going into bank loans. It's not going into new capacity and the type of things that could cause the economy to grow and actually generate some inflation. It's just going into speculation. Banks, financial institutions are leveraging up 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 times, buying low-yield bonds with very little carry costs for short-term interest. And they're making money that way. Their earnings is coming from speculation. As David Stockman calls it, it's a casino economy. And the Fed is actually encouraging this, not because they really like it. It's because if they're going to keep this bubble going and keep the financial institutions from breaking down, they got to keep the economy growing at some minimal rate, and they got to keep throwing money in that these people can lever their investments to keep going. If they didn't, they would have melted down just like they were doing in late 2008. The whole system, and not just the banks and investment banks, but AIG, General Motors, you know, everything was melting down exactly like the early 30s, and that's what would have happened. So they're doing this endless money printing and endless speculation and just to keep the system from falling down, and it's understandable from only one viewpoint. It's horrible. It's going to be reprehensible in history, but if you're the head of the central bank in any major country, or you're the president or premier or prime minister of any major country, do you want to have the next Great Depression on your watch, or do you want to keep it going until you get out of office and let the next sucker take it? I mean, that's what it really comes down to. Nobody wants this to happen. Bernanke's luck, you know, Greenspan got out of the way. He created the bubble. Bernanke didn't create the bubble. Greenspan had much more to do with creating the bubble. He got out of the way just before it burst. Bernanke got in there and pumped it up and got out of the way just before it's going to burst again. And guess who's going to take it in the chin? Janet Yellen and the next president. Well, actually, I think that this next crash is probably going to happen before the next election. So, basically, in this case, Obama's going to take it on the chin.
Yeah, and I don't understand why somebody like Obama, who doesn't have any time, I mean, he can't run again. Why wouldn't he just come out and say, "Listen, folks, we're going to have to go through some really tough times. You can't hurt me because I can't get elected anyway. But we're going to have to go through this, and we're going to have to reset what we're doing, and we're going to have to bite the bullet for a couple years, but." The next president, whoever is, hopefully they can pull you out of whatever we get through. And if we had done that back in 08, we would probably have a roaring economy right now.
Well, see, that's the point. It's too late to do that, because if you did do that, any austerity at all, any stopping of stimulus, any reset at all would cause an avalanche. And there's just no two ways around that. So it would kill. If Obama did that, it would kill the Democratic candidate, because we would not turn around in time. You're right. What he should have done, he walked in. In early 2009, after the crisis had already happened, he didn't cause it, didn't have one damn thing to do with it. That's when he should have had the courage to say, "Look, I'm a new president. I didn't cause this, but I'm looking at the debt. I'm looking at this. I'm looking at the leverage. I'm looking at blah, blah, blah. We have to go through a difficult thing." This is exactly what Margaret Thatcher, politician with balls in the last century, other than Winston Churchill and a few people, that's what she did in the early 80s. She came in and said, "We got to tough this out and deal with this early 80s recession and this disinflation crisis and come out the other side." And they did. If he'd have done that in 2009, you're right, we would have had this reset. It could have been softened somewhat by government policies, by helping to give the banks some cushion as they restructure this debt. We would have been coming out of this. The worst crisis in U.S. history, the Great Depression, only lasted about 2.5-3 years. The stock crash only lasted a little under 3 years, and in the depression lasted a little over 3 years. It doesn't take long to make this reset if you let it happen. The free market system knows, just like if your body eats bad sushi and you get, you know, food poisoning, your body knows what to do about that. And what does it do? It flushes everything out at the speed of light. It knows exactly what to do. That's exactly what the economy did in the early 30s. That's exactly what it was doing in late 2008, early 2009. And central bankers and politicians and all their arrogance and Goldman Sachs, or they called in Goldman Sachs, the foxes, into the hen house, They said, no, we're not going to have a Great Depression. We're just going to keep this bubble going. That's exactly what they decided. I mean, and that is going to look, as I said earlier, that's going to look incredibly irresponsible. How did people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s in gray pinstripe suits and PhDs and MBAs come up with this stupid-ass conclusion?
Well, you know, Harry, you're making me feel good because I think a lot of us had some sense of optimism. Of course, that was kind of what Obama ran on. Of course, we didn't really know much about Obama, but, you know, there was a certain sense of optimism, whether or not you voted for him or not, I think. And then he started picking his cabinet, and he picked Timothy Geithner, you know, Mr. Fox. and I said, oh, man, we're in trouble. And you've just kind of, you know, you've won my case already. So thank you.
Spoken like a true attorney. Well, listen, Harry, we appreciate your time. It's been a great morning. You've given our listeners a lot of information, and I'm going to be talking about your Irrational Economic Summit as we get off the line here. But thank you, Harry. Be talking to either you or Rodney in another month.
Okay, and also, that's a great time. Mid-July to mid-September is the best time in Vancouver. It's my favorite city in all of North America.
Oh, I can't wait to get back. I mean, it is a beautiful, beautiful city, and being in And October is going to be absolutely gorgeous.
That's actually going to be early September.
Or September,
right,
I mean,
that perfect zone for weather.
Well, any time in the Northwest in July through October, we have unbelievably great weather out here. So, yeah, you bet. It's a great thing. And not only that, for you investors out there, this is a great opportunity to hear Harry, Rodney, and some of the best speakers you will ever hear in your life. We're going to take a quick break and come right back with Investing Simplified.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm. And I can't hope to talk as much about the economy as Harry did, because I don't know as much about the economy as Harry does. But anyway, and we're going to talk about today on Carl's comments, something we haven't talked about, I don't think, much at all. And that's limited liability companies as part of an estate planning part of thing. And it's not always for most people, but occasionally it's a useful tool that we employ as part of an estate planning strategy. It's also an asset protection strategy. But first of all, I'm going to go to the basics. A limited liability company is sort of like a cross between a corporation and a partnership. It's sort of like a partnership because it's a little less formal structure, but it's also like a corporation because it affords the owners of the limited liability company to have limited liability. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that the company itself, the obligations of the company, their loans, their leases, and things like that, if everything goes bad, the partners or the owners of the company in a limited liability company, they're on the hook only for what they put into it. They're not personally liable for the obligations of the company. And so, for example, if you to put that into context with a with an individual or a family, if you have, say, for example, you have a bunch of rentals and you own those rentals individually, and one of those rentals you find that you have the tenant from hell, and the tenant from hell somehow gets a judgment against you for some innocuous insult that you've made, and it costs you $1 million over your insurance. Now, this is far-fetched, but nonetheless, that's the idea. And this guy gets a judgment against you, and so he can come after your personal assets if you own everything personally, and get his $1 million. Whereas if this tenant from hell was a tenant in one of your properties, and that property happened to be in an LLC, and you and your family owned this in the LLC, that same tenant would only get what was in the LLC, not all the other stuff. Wouldn't be able to come after your personal assets. So that's the asset protection aspect of it. Asset protection generally, I think the idea of good insurance is number one, no matter what. You should have that anyway if you have LLCs either. But then sometimes LLCs can be a useful tool for that kind of asset protection. And it usually works, you know, kind of really well with real estate rentals and things like that. Ongoing businesses, certainly a lot of people who set up businesses use an LLC. And in many instances, that's a really good way to go. So anyway, then the estate planning part of it is, for one thing, if you own assets in an LLC, like real estate, it's a little easier to transfer in and out. You know, I mean, you can transfer your LLC into a trust real easily, but you can't transfer, you know, real property quite as easily. So it's a useful tool that way. And also, the membership interest on an LLC is what we call personal property, not real property. And personal property is looked at differently from the standpoint of estate tax. Typically speaking, personal property becomes part of your estate for estate tax purposes in the state where you live, your domicile, the state where you live or where you die, I guess. And real estate tends to be taxed in the state where it's located. So, for example, if you live in the state of Washington and you have a $2 million exemption for your estate, and you also own real property in Oregon, however, say you own $1 million worth of Oregon real estate, or $1.2 million in Oregon real estate. Well, that gets taxed in Oregon to a certain extent if you die in Washington. However, and they kind of, it's a funny sort of formula that works between the two, you know, the two, but nonetheless, it can possibly end up in some taxation in Oregon, even though you're a Washington resident. But if you own that real estate in an LLC, you would own the membership interest in that LLC. The LLC, in turn, would own the real estate. The LLC doesn't die. You do. Your membership interest is a personal property. And so since you died in Washington, the value of that ends up in Washington, and you got your $2 million exemption, so you get tax-free. So that's one way to kind of look at it. And that's kind of a technique that actually some people, you know, employ. There are quite a few people who live in Vancouver area and own and operate businesses and all sorts of stuff in Oregon. And so it's nicer to have the exemption.
Say it isn't so.
And you know, your address is what? No.
Yeah. You know, Carl, that's very true. And a lot of our clients, when they retire, they end up moving from Oregon over to Washington.
You know, there are some distinct advantages to Washington, now there may be some disadvantages in some sense. You know, if you live in Washington, you have sales tax and stuff like that. But as a practical matter, there from a retirement standpoint, you know, you're going to go. Typically, as Harry would say, after you're retired, you know, people, their demographics are such that you're probably not going to spend as much as you would. So the sales tax doesn't bite you quite as bad as it would if you were, you know, buying new cars and stuff all the time.
Yeah, you know, the average person in America buys their last new car sometime between 60 and 65.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm probably even worse because I got this 1999 Dodge pickup. I'm going to be buried in that thing, you know. I mean, so.
Well, you know, I just saw in the news there that there's a bill that Congress is going to vote on to do away with the inheritance tax.
Well, yeah, but guess who's gonna veto it?
I heard that too. No, the only reason I thought they brought that up is because the limitation now is about $11,000
per couple. Yeah.
And I think it's because the net worth of all the politicians has gotten higher than that.
So they want to raise the limits again because the politicians have got their net worth higher,
and you know, boy, they got a problem, don't they?
Oh yeah, it's really tough being a congressman in this place, you know.
yeah. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break and come back with Investing Simplified. Listen, if you got a question, pick up the phone, give us a call. There is no foolish question when it comes to your money. Pick up the phone and call us at 503-417-7626. Toll free, 800-990-0750. If you want to ask us a question about our interview with Harry, that's fine too. Give us a call. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
We do Investing Simplified.
Hi, everybody. Chuck Price, the financial doctor here. If you're between ages 58 and 68, choosing Social Security benefits at the right time is one of the biggest financial decisions you'll ever make. You get one chance to get it right. After 12 months, there are no do-overs. 74% of Americans receive reduced benefits. Get your free report on 44 Social Security secrets at pfgwm.com. Social Security is often one of the largest and most mismanaged assets in your retirement income plan. Claiming benefits sounds easy. So is leaving up to $250,000 of your money with the government, or reducing your benefits up to 76% over your life expectancy. For this vital information, go online to pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
We do Investing Simplified.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had $1 million...
Well, we're back with Investing Simplified, and if you had $1 million, you should give us a call immediately, and we will have some ideas for you. We'll point out today that Kevin is recuperating from doing income taxes and getting extensions and doing all those things that CPAs do, so he's taking a little time off this weekend and getting a well-deserved rest break. But Carl and I are here to answer your questions. I do want to follow up with Harry's comments and talk a little bit about the stock market, because I think one of the things that I've been talking about on our show, Carl, since we've been on the air, is about the market and what the market's really doing, and Harry is exactly right about what's happening in the marketplace and the earnings of the stocks. And I've been reporting this for some time, and the Dow Jones closed at 17,826. Now, if we go back to 10,907 before that market correction, The Dow was sitting at 14,164.53. And I want you to understand something. That's the high, guys. That was the high point, and then the market crashed. But since that time, to get back to there, the market in 7 years and 6.25 months is up 25.85% in 7 years and 6 months and a quarter. That works out to 3.44% per year. The Dow Jones closed 12/31/99 at 11,497.12. So it's up 55.05% in 14 years and 3.5 months. And that works out to 3.85% return. Harry is exactly right. You can't go take, why would you take a risk in the market and make those kind of returns? It's not there right now. And it's certainly not there now because we're way up there. And if you take a look and go farther, we look at the S&P, 500 best stocks, growth stocks in America. S&P closed at 2,081.18 on Friday, yesterday. Now, where do we stand versus the S&P close on 10907 at 1565.15? Well, we're up 32.97. So in 7 years and 6.25 months, we're up 4.38%. That is not exciting. If we go back and look at the S&P back to 12/31/99 that closed at 14.69.25, it's up 41.65. So in 14 years and 3.5 months, it's done an average of 2.91%. I just want to point out, since the new century, the Dow Jones real rate of return, this is money in your pocket, your earnings investing in the Dow Jones, was 3.85% per year. The S&P over that same period, 14 years, 3.5 months, is up 2.91% per year. That is unbelievable in any historical time. And so what I would say to you out there as an investor, look at the track records of the investments you're investing in. Actually ask the questions. Let me see the track record of what your portfolio did in the last market correction. What did your fund do? How long did it take to recover? What did the stock do? How long did it take to recover? Because what Harry's saying, and I've been saying this for some time, I think we're going to have another correction, only this one, I think, is going to be a little longer to recovery, maybe 7 to 9 years. So if you don't have a strategy that's designed to react in that kind of a market volatility, you better be looking around. And let me tell you, there's a lot of guys out there selling investment programs that are nothing more than indexed annuities. And they're not investments. The legal word for them is an insurance contract. It is not an investment. And the guys on the radio, I hear them all the time, call them investments, and that ought to be your first clue they don't tell you the truth. If you hear that, you need to be asking yourself, why are they calling it that? Why aren't they saying what it really is? It's an annuity. There's a guy that does an advertisement on TV all over here, and he's bald-headed, and he does an ad, and he said his clients never lost a dime during the crash of 2008. That's correct, but they never made any money either. You know, he just kind of forgets that out, and he says, they make a reasonable rate of return. Well, they make a reasonable rate of return depending on the riders they have built into that contract. If they have an income rider into that contract, which most of them do, they actually lost money because of the charge of the index rider. And I'm going to tell you right now, I talk to people all the time who do business with some of these other guys out there that are selling these products, and they never explain to the person, when we have a bad year, look at your portfolio. They're supposed to show you. The thing is, if you sign the paperwork that you read it and you saw it, after 10 days, you own it. What's that word?
Buyer beware, caveat emptor.
Yeah, buyer beware. So all I'm saying to you is, before you spend your hard-earned money, it never hurts to get a second opinion. But more importantly of all, ask the questions. Okay, what did this annuity do in 2008? What did this investment do in 2007, 8, and 9 when the market crashed? What was the recovery time? What did it do? I got news for you. If you really look at those numbers, you're going to kind of rethink your own, you know, most people are intelligent enough that they've earned the money. You just need to ask the right questions to be intelligent enough to keep your money. And I'm saying that not to be nasty about it. It's just that it is a fact of life. And unfortunately, when I run into it, a lot of times it's too late. People have already put their money into something. They're tied up into it and they can't get out of it. And if they've had it longer than 10 days, they're stuck.
Well, you know, there are certainly a lot of people out in the world who are trying to sell you something. And they want to portray it in its best light, of course. I think a lot of people are well-intentioned in that, doing that, and sometimes they do a good service, maybe most of the time, I don't know. But the problem is that when things are, you get some people who are just out and out trying to make the biggest commission they possibly can, and they don't care what they're selling you. I don't think most people do that, but there are a few, I suppose. Just like, you know, there are lawyers out there who take some pretty difficult positions with their clients, and that's unfortunate too. But I know that the lawyers get if you do something that's really unethical, the Oregon State Bar is very, very rigorous about going after lawyers who screw up and mess with people. And I can tell you that every month they publish a list of the lawyers that got, you know, disciplined or disbarred, and I'm sure your organizations do too from time to time. They get in trouble with that sort of thing. But if you don't feel comfortable with a lawyer or with a financial advisor, you should go talk to somebody else and see how they stack up next to them. You know, feel if you're comfortable with them, you know, do they answer your questions in a way that you understand? Do they tell you how much it's going to cost? I mean, what are the fees and, you know, what are the costs? I mean, if anybody asks me my fees, I tell them what I think it's going to cost and all sorts, I don't hide that.
Carl, that's one of the things I think people have a tendency to not do, to not inquire, and they need to do that. They need to ask right up front, what is the cost of this? What are the fees? And I just want you to understand something, folks. There is no free lunch. Nobody works for free. If you believe somebody works for free, fantasy lands at Disneyland. Because nobody works for free. Everybody gets paid. They get paid somehow. Some way, they're getting paid. And it's just like I was talking to a person about funds, and he said, well, I bought a mutual fund that's a no-load mutual fund, so I'm not paying any fees. And I said, no, you just didn't read the prospectus.
Yeah. Well, who reads those things anyway?
Yeah, who reads those things anyhow? Because you're paying a fee. I mean, Charles Schwab doesn't make $20-plus million a year because he doesn't charge fees. You know, I mean, that is a financial fact.
I'm shocked. Yeah, I thought he was just a nice guy. I really.
Yeah, he's just a nice guy. And they just offer investments for free. Yeah. No, nobody works for free. I mean, that's the first thing we want to understand. Now the question is what is the fee you're paying giving you in a return? And I always say to people, in fact, I've got a whiteboard presentation on my website. If you think low fees are the answer to investing and the only reason to invest is to make money. If I don't care if you're whatever the fee is, if you're making money, that's the whole point. That's what you want to be doing when you're investing. Now you want to pay a reasonable price for it, obviously, but you want to get a return too. That's one of the big reasons to invest is to make some money. And sometimes there is no investment I've ever seen, and I've been doing this for over 40 years. There's no investment I've ever seen that makes money every single year in and year out. They all have a little blip once in a while. They all get smacked. That's why it's called investment.
Yeah, investment is defined by its risk almost.
That's exactly correct. It is.
It has. That's the
absolutely. This is for all of our listeners. If you've been listening to our show and you listen to Harry Dent today, if you want to come by my office, I have about 20 books left. I have Harry Dent's book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. And I got to tell you, for all the naysayers who may have, who don't like Harry Dent or whatever, The fact is, Harry's been right on about this. Harry has totally nailed it on deflation. And if you don't understand demographics, you don't understand investing. So I highly recommend, I give you a book for free. I mean, that's, you know, that is free. They'll give you a free book. If you come by the office, and I've had several people stop by in the last few weeks since I've been doing this, and we're getting down less and less books. And as long as I got them, I'll give them away. You know, that's why I think it's so important that you get this. Knowledge is power. The best investors I have, the best clients I have, are educated investors. They understand what we're doing. They understand the strategy that we're doing to help them make money. Do we have all the answers? No, but we know where to find them. You know, we don't have all the answers. That's why I introduced the concept about the financial doctor, because the financial doctor is the guy that kind of quarterbacks and gets the other experts in there. If you need an estate planning surgeon, I call on Carl. If you need a tax surgeon, I'm going to call on Kevin. If you need a long-term care, I have a person that specializes in long-term care for my clients. I have a person that specializes in liability and insurance to protect your assets. You know, you got to cover your assets at all times. And we have people that can help us do that. I don't do everything. I think you got to be careful out there with the advisor that's the jack of all trades and master of none. You want to have some people that work together, plus the fact it keeps everybody honest when you're working together with other professionals. You can bounce things off each other, and you do the best thing for the client. And that is our fiduciary responsibility, is to put the client first. You're listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back next week. Carl, how does somebody get a hold of you?
You can reach me by phone at 503-255-8795 or at warrenallen.com on the web.
And you can reach me at 503-253-3000 or toll-free 877-50-PRICE on the web at pfgwm.com. Or also at askthefinancialdoctor.com. I will say we're going to be making a special offer on our book, Investing Simplified, and I'll announce that next week. But in the meantime, you can get it off my website, and you can also get it at amazon.com. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week with Investing Simplified.